All right. Well, good morning, everybody. If you have Bibles or your phones, you can turn to Acts 19. We'll get there in just a minute. So first of all, if you don't know me, my name's Travis. I'm one of the pastors here at Summit View. We have four pastors, myself, John Larson, Aaron Ritter, Perry Paulding. And we kind of take turns teaching up here. We've been in the book of Acts. We're on Acts 19 today. And our series is called To Each One. The idea that Acts is a pretty good picture for us that kind of cuts through all of the history and sort of culture and everything else that we've kind of tacked on to church and just the expression of Christianity. You know, a lot of years of doing that and a lot of generations and a lot of stuff just culturally. If you want to know what authentic Christianity is, there's no better place to look than the book of Acts. So that's one reason why we're in Acts. The other thing about the book of Acts is it's a picture of how the church spread, how the gospel started being shared, and then people went out and churches started and the world started to understand the way, as it was called back then, the way of following Jesus Christ. And so we're saying that, you know, in this series, we're examining what that means, what that looks like. What does it look like to go to each one, each person, whether in your local area or even thinking about going to the ends of the earth with unreached people groups? And so we're examining that and how the early church did that. And really, ultimately, it just puts God on display and his power, because the power of God is so great and God is advancing his kingdom. So, but first of all, I have my next slide here. There we go. You guys know Debbie Campbell? Most of us know Debbie Campbell. I've had the privilege to be on staff with Debbie since about 4 or 5 months after 19 years as office administrator, answering phones, odds and ends, all kinds of stuff. Basically, every single one of you has been touched by her influence, and we all even experience, if Debbie goes out of town, stuff happens. Like, this room might be too cold or too hot. You know, she thinks through all the details that help make church possible for us in the building, and all kinds of stuff outside of that, and she's affected all of us in a major way. One of the verses that came to mind as I was thinking about Debbie retiring, that's what she just retired this past Friday, was that verse in Matthew 10, 42. It says, whoever gives one of these little ones even a cup of cold water because he is a disciple, truly I say to you, he will by no means lose his reward. And Debbie has served us faithfully. She's, like I said, touched every single one of our lives. We're so grateful for her. We're excited for the next chapter of her world. She's watching us via live stream. Debbie, hi. Her and Doug are out there. So, just, yeah, round of applause for Debbie. Debbie, we love you. We've appreciated you. And then just a short word of exhortation for all of us, because I think every single one of us is probably going to experience a few little bumps along the way. So if you had called to use the building for a reservation, you talk to Debbie. Now, we're trying to figure out how some of that stuff is going to get played out amongst our staff and what we're going to do next. As of right now, there may be a few moments where you call and maybe get a voicemail. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. We might have some moments where maybe the temperature in a room is not quite right, or, you know, so on and so forth. She did her job fantastically, and I think we're going to feel it a little bit for a little bit. So let's be gracious with one another as that happens and as that plays out, all right? Cool. Okay, on to Acts. But actually, I have a real quick story first. We can look at Debbie while I tell this. So years and years ago, when I was young, I was probably in middle school or something like that, there was a conference called Promise Keepers. All these men would come from out of state to Boulder, Colorado. It's not really part of the story. It's just all these men came. And there was a moment after one of those, I think I was in middle school, and my dad organized a backpacking trip with all these guys that had come from different states. And so we did this backpacking trip. And if you've ever done backpacking, you know, you put everything in a pack on your back and you walk along. And you might hike for quite a while. And you've packed in your food and your bedding and your tent and everything that you need. So it's on your back. So it's in your best interest to pack light. Because 6 miles go by, 10 miles go by, and you really start feeling every single ounce that you put in that pack. And so you have to be really strategic with how you pack for the journey. So we were going, and there were some guys that came along, and one of these guys, he was probably 19 or 20, he'd come in from out of town, and our hike the first day was going to be about 6 miles, then we would camp at about 10,000 feet on this mountain, and we go fishing and stuff like that. And we had our frame packs, and so I got my frame pack, and you know, I'm a kid, but I've done this a lot, and so I had it my strategy. You know, I've got this light sleeping bag, and I've got this light pad that just barely enough to keep me up off the ground. I've got this little tiny tent. It's all light, right? And you pack light with food, and we get about 6 miles into our first hike, and this guy, he's an athlete. He's probably 19, 20, something like that. And he starts looking just really, really pale and almost passes out. And so my dad comes alongside him, and he's sitting down on the side of the trail, and we're almost to our campsite, but not quite. But we got 2 more days of this, and so my dad's getting concerned, right? And I'm just like, what's going on, guys? Like, let's keep going. You know, and so finally my dad's like, well, let's just redistribute some of your weight. Let's open this up and let's just put some of your stuff in other guys' packs. And so he opens it up. And right on the top of his pack is one of these. This is not working. I'm pushing the button. Is it plugged in? There we go. This is a Dutch oven made out of cast iron. So this is this first problem. This guy can carry a lot of weight. He's strong. He's an athlete. But 6 miles in with this in the top of his pack, plus all the things he intended to cook in it, which were canned and had a lot of liquid in them, the guy's pack weighed like 100 pounds. My dad's like, well, that's for car camping, not for backpacking. You need to plan differently for your trip. So just in case you're wondering if you really want to use one of these, this is how it's supposed to be used. See, this is my friend Elijah Mullins. This is us when we were camping. I took this picture, and he cooked us an amazing dinner in a Dutch oven. That's what these things are called, Dutch oven. They're about 20 pounds, you know. But you see back there, see the pop-up trailer that he pulled with his car? This was stored in that. So just a quick illustration that the things that we carry with us oftentimes weigh us down. And in our case, we managed to get him through, but we had to, each one of us, take on extra weight. And it was completely unnecessary. He did cook us a gourmet meal that evening, which was good. But we could have had a meal about just as good without all of the stuff that he had taken with him. So it was a heavy, heavy burden. Just keep that in your mind as we talk through what we're going to talk about today, that sometimes we can carry stuff with us with a heavy load that will fatigue us and wipe us out and take us out along the way in a journey that is this life. So let's turn to Acts, and we're going to read through. I'm just going to go kind of verse by verse for a bit here, and then we'll get into some application, right? So we're going to start in verse 21. So Perry Paulding preached last week on the first part of this chapter. There's some pretty amazing things that happened. And so our first verse in verse 21 says, now after these events, so what events were those? Basically, Paul arrives in Ephesus. He's got some friends there, Priscilla and Aquila and the great orator Apollos, and they've done the groundwork, the breaking work, ground of basically starting a church in Ephesus. If you don't know about Ephesus, here's where Ephesus is, just for all of us, for a reminder, it's in Asia Minor. Ephesus is up there. See it on the map here, kind of above Crete there, kind of Mediterranean north in modern-day Turkey. Ephesus was a city back then that was a prominent city in Rome. Right around this time, Ephesus probably had about 300,000 people as the population. You know, a lot of times we don't think of ancient cities being that large, and by ancient standards, that's ginormous. It's on a port, so it's an important city for commerce. The economy is very, very important. Rome eventually came in and conquered the area, and they recognized this is an important place, and so they made it kind of the political center of Asia Minor. And so Paul, in the early church, he sees this is a strategic place to go and win converts and actually make a church happen. And from there, it's going to be an awesome place to just kind of spread the gospel around into Asia Minor because this place has so much influence. And so when Rome came in, you know, they said, oh, hey, this place is interesting. They've got this temple to the goddess Diana, which was, this is one name for this goddess. Another name for this goddess that we're going to see here is Artemis. And they worship, and they're very religious. And they said, okay, you can continue to do that as long as you also include emperor worship. So you have to worship the emperor of Rome. And they're like, all right, we can do that. That's great. So after these events, that's basically, it's all getting started, and there's a lot of people that have been converted, and as they become converted, because this place is very, very religious, they have a lot of religious icons and idols and books and pagan things in their households, and they bring all that out, and Perry described it last week, that they started getting rid of these things, and they burned them in public in the sight of all. And it came out to a fortune in terms of the monetary value of all of these things. So it's affecting the way of Christ. Gospel sharing, gospel spreading, church being established, it's starting to affect the local economy. So now after these events, Paul resolved in the Spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. Paul is a strategist. He's looking at what strategically is going to be the best place for him to go next to spread the gospel. So he's outlining a plan, and this plan, you can read through the Gospels, you can read through Acts, you can read into his letters, and you can kind of see, okay, this actually started playing out maybe in different ways than he had planned, but he got to most of these places. He says, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. He ends up in Rome eventually, probably not in the way that he expected. He ends up in prison in Rome, and we'll get to that later, you know, probably not today, but other days you can read in the Bible. Having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he sent them ahead of him. He himself stayed in Asia for a while. Interesting anecdote, 1 Corinthians is probably written during this time. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, you can see there's a verse there where he talks about staying in Ephesus for a while, and that's probably this. So at this point, he's thinking about the Corinthian church, and he stays, and he writes his letter, but he sends it on. Okay, so about that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. So the public at large has realized what's happening. 300,000 people in this city, and that public, that large population, has realized something's going on. They're seeing these people pull all of their pagan idols and everything else out, and the economy is getting affected, right? Okay, so further on, it says, for a man, verse 24, a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. So the economy is getting affected, and they have these guilds back then. So tradesmen would kind of get together, sort of like a modern-day union. They'd get together, make sure they can kind of ensure their income, have common practices, etc. We don't really know this man's role, except that he becomes a spokesman for the Guild of Silversmiths because their idol-making business is in jeopardy. And he says, he gathered these together, the craftsmen, with the workmen in similar trades and said, men, you know from this business we have our wealth. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. Boy, what an interesting moment. It's more just a narrative in this space. There's not necessarily a lot of theology to unpack in this passage. But I love this moment because we have someone who's probably not, based on his profession that we're, you know, seeing here, he's probably not going out of his way to listen to Paul. He's probably not. But Paul's message is so clear and so focused as Paul shares the gospel. Every time Paul shares the gospel, he brings up idolatry. Idolatry as something completely opposed to the gospel. And this is a great statement. He's quoting Paul. He says, this man, Paul, he says, gods that are made, you know, basically by human hands, crafted, aren't gods. What a powerful statement. And here we have a man who's not a follower of Jesus. He's not familiar with Christianity from an insider perspective. He's on the outside, and he's going, this is their message. And it's so clear. I love that. Paul's message is being communicated through the mouth of this pagan idol maker. And it's true. You kind of see the absurdity in that, of course, here in modern day. We don't go out and make idols. We go, yeah, duh. You go carve a piece of wood. It's not a god. That just seems completely and utterly absurd, right? So let's go continue on. I do have some notes here. I'll be checking out here and there. So he says, you know, from this business, we have our wealth. We have our wealth from this business. I think that's another key piece. This is affecting something that's close to him. His first statement is not, hey, they're defaming the name of our God. It's, this is jeopardizing my income. You see what's important. And then he does say, there's a danger, verse 27, not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship. He says almost all Asia twice there, in that the message of Paul has been communicated so much at this point. It's probably 3 years or so maybe that Paul has been in this region, this area, sharing this. Just think about any place I've been for 3 years. I'm not sure that all of the continent or all of the surrounding countryside has heard my message, but Paul's message is so clear that this guy says, our profession across all of Asia, Asia Minor, the known Asia at that point, is in jeopardy because of this one man's message and his group of followers now as they convert everybody. There's just so much power in that message. I love how clear that is. And it kind of puts me to shame, I think. What part of our message is actually getting out there? I don't know. But anyway, this is modern day. This is where the temple of Artemis was. This pillar is actually, that pillar's there. I read it was about 18 meters high. That's pretty high. But all that really is actually pieces of pillars that they found after the whole thing had been destroyed, and somebody at some point put all those pieces up on top of each other to resemble one of the original pillars. But those are all pieces of the original pillars of the temple. This temple was actually pretty big. It was 420 feet long by 250 feet wide, and lots of people would descend on it. It was kind of the religious center of the space, and people would come and they would purchase these idols, these little pieces of silver and wood, and they'd carry them to their houses. And, you know, the Bible talks about these idols a lot. There's actually lots of different references to them because they'd have them in their house, and the Bible refers to it as household gods. Back in Genesis or 1 Samuel 19 or Hosea 3, you see places where people are carrying this and traveling with these burdens of wood and metal, thinking somehow they're going to protect them and sustain them and give them good things. And they would go to this place to purchase them. And so he's going, look what it's doing to our business. People aren't coming to buy our things. In fact, they're publicly burning them and making a spectacle of this. And so our income is in jeopardy. And he also is saying, you know what, and also sort of our national pride in Artemis and this temple and all this stuff that we hold so close to us, it's being jeopardized. And I feel convicted as well because, you know, I think about our church and I think about the things we spend our money on and I think about, you know, in their world, their commitment to follow Christ affected what they purchased and what businesses they went to. And I wonder if the American church, I wonder if some of you church, if we were to truly follow the way of Jesus, if our economy would be affected at all. I wonder. I just wonder. I wonder. You know, not a super dig, maybe just looking at myself more than anybody. But I wonder. I just have that. Okay, so verse 28, here's their response. When they heard this, they were enraged and crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." There's always scenes like this whenever idolatry is confronted. There's scenes like this throughout the Bible. I think about Elijah when he's with the priests of Baal and they're trying to bring down fire on that altar. And the priests of Baal just get enraged. It's like almost like a riot amongst themselves. There's 400 some of them, and I picture the spectacle. When idolatry starts getting called out, riots can happen. Riots can happen. Jeremiah 50:33 says, they're mad over their idols. There's attitude that comes from idol worship, and the truth is making them angry. And so they're getting furious, and I even think about like what happens in mobs and what happens as people get enraged and there's just irrationality and they start just chanting this, "Great is Artemis, great is Artemis." Just picture that with a whole bunch of people. And I think forward to when the angry mob came to Jesus and they're shouting in front of Pilate, "Crucify him, crucify him, crucify him." Like this is this as one voice Picture all these people come together. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. And so, next verse, the city was filled with confusion. They rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's companions in travel. Oh man, that I think that's pretty fascinating. This is that theater that they dragged them into. And this is the theater today. It's still there. This theater can hold about 30,000 people-ish, something like that. Now, I don't know if in this moment, if it actually did fill up with that many people, but they had enough of a crowd that they had to get to a space that could hold them. And so imagine a giant crowd of people filling this space, and Paul's two companions are dragged in there. That's kind of freaky. So Gaius, if you go to the next chapter, we'll get to this in a week or two here. Gaius, it says Gaius is from Derbe. He's just a friend of Paul's. We don't really know much about him. We have Aristarchus. It says he's from Macedonia. If he's the same one that's also listed in Acts 20, he's from Thessalonica. And he actually ends up, as Paul writes in a later letter, being a fellow prisoner with Paul in Rome. And so these are guys that are close to Paul. They're close to the ministry. And we're not really sure what's going to happen to them, right? It doesn't really say much. It doesn't seem like much happened to them. But it's verse 30, when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. So the disciples recognize, Paul, you're the person they're enraged at. And if you go in there, they're going to rip you limb from limb. And I wonder what's going through Paul's mind at this point. Because, like, this is his third missionary journey. He has experienced near death multiple times. He's experienced miraculous power from God. He's experienced healing. He has experienced so much. Just in his mind, he's got to think, God's so powerful, I'm basically invincible at this point. So he wants to go confront the mob. I also think, you know, another thing that's in his mind at this point is, hey, this is an opportunity. There's a huge group of people. I could share the gospel with them. So let me go. And they hold him back. He's like, no, I want to go. And I love his zeal. But I also like what happened with the disciples because I think they were wise to hold him back. Because in this moment, there is a reality that Paul's faith, it's a huge faith. But in some ways, if you jump into a situation like that, it could be considered reckless. Could God save him from a mad mob that's trying to kill him? Of course. But I think there's a little bit of a distinction that we have to pull in here. I was thinking about this. Does this mean like the disciples had less faith than Paul? I'm not sure that that's true. Because I think when danger comes to us, God, we have to have faith. Faith actually is something that helps us. We believe God can get us out of it. Sort of like back in the day in Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, danger came to them, right? They had no choice in the matter but to follow God and end up in the fiery furnace. And what did God do? God came through for them, right? But maybe take that little piece out of it, where they had no choice, and say, okay, well, you have the choice. You could throw yourself in the fiery furnace, but you don't have to. You know, no, we're not going to make you bow down or anything like that. You wouldn't recklessly just throw yourself in fire. There wouldn't be a reason for that. It's sort of like, I could go lay down in a busy highway. Could God save me from getting run over? Could he? He could. But it would be reckless. None of us would say that that's a good idea, right? Would you say that I lack faith in God because I'm not going to go do that right now after church? You wouldn't say that. You say God gave me a brain, right? And he's expecting me to use it in a logical, rational way. Well, I think there's another spiritual principle at play here because if Paul does have a choice, and the choice is basically like one where he doesn't have to go appear before that mob. He has a choice to strategize and maybe go in a different time when they're not so angry. They do quiet down after a while. At this point, it looks like certain death. If certain death is there, he probably shouldn't go in there. It's pragmatic. It's good. right? But I think there's a principle here of testing God, because if I go and I say, okay, I'm going to test God, I've got my faith here and my faith that God can pull me through, I'm going to go lay down on a busy highway, God's going to make all the cars, you know, feather light, and they won't hurt me. Well, I'd be putting the Lord God to the test in a very bad way. I just wanted to say that. I think the disciples were right. I think when you read the whole of Scripture, you see certain passages that seem to be kind of a promise, and then you see in other places a verification of that. Well, let me just do a modern day example. And this might feel like me calling some people out, and I'm okay with that, because I think we need to be solid biblically. We need to understand what we're believing as we step into places with faith. So during this season, as we've been wearing masks, during this season, as we've had a real virus, during this season where I have people who have been close to me who have either been affected, hospitalized, or even have passed away from the virus, it's a very real risk. If you deny that, we've got a different conversation that we should have. That's real. We can pretty much agree on that, right? How that affects government overreach and everything else, I don't want to go into that right now, but we know there's a real risk, right? I have heard of worship services being held with people in attendance that are knowingly positive for COVID-19 and prayers being uttered and vision being cast that because worship of God is happening, we should have enough faith that that COVID would not transfer to other people in the room. So we shouldn't all wear masks. Let's just trust that God can heal and God can keep that plague from our door. And I just took some notes here because I think that this moment with Paul kind of reveals some of that. Psalm 91 is a verse that I've heard of being claimed. Psalm 91, verse 5, 6, 7, "You shall not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by the day, nor the pestilence that stalks in the darkness." There's obvious reference to a virus, pestilence that stalks. You shall not fear this. So come, take your mask off. Let's sing together. If you're COVID positive, that's okay. Don't fear it. Don't fear that pestilence, that virus. Stalks in the darkness, nor the destruction that wastes of the noonday. Verse 7, 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. Okay, let's claim that promise. We're going to claim it. We're going to name it. We're going to name the enemy. The pestilence is COVID-19. It shall not come near us, right? It's like, it seems viable when you read that psalm. Verse 10, no evil shall be allowed to befall you, no plague come near your tent. Okay, I'm going to claim that. And it feels like faith. It feels like belief. But if you read the Bible, which I'd encourage all of us to do in its whole breadth from start to finish, you would understand that the very next verse in Psalm 91, verse 11, says this: "He will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone." And you think, oh my goodness, I'm invincible if this applies to me. But if you read the whole Bible, you go forward to Matthew 4, where Jesus is being tempted by Satan. And Satan reads this verse to tempt Jesus to test God. "The devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, 'If you're the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written, he will command his angels concerning you. On their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone.'" Be reckless. Dive into that crowded theater where certain death is imminent. Lay down in front of the Mack truck on the freeway. Knowingly expose someone to COVID. God's going to save you. No. Jesus says, and you know, you think about it. If Jesus had done that, could God have saved him? Yes. Could the angels have come and kept him from dying? Absolutely. But Jesus rebukes him. He says, "No, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test." So the disciples come alongside Paul and they go, "Don't presume on God. Don't put God to the test. Let's be pragmatic about this. This has nothing to do with how much faith you have, Paul. That's certain death. There's a later time for you to get in there and share that gospel message. For now, let's let that crowd quiet down. God gave us brains. It is not faith to be reckless. If danger comes our way and we find ourselves in a fiery furnace through no action of our own, or because we have to, we don't have a choice, stand up for Jesus Christ. Absolutely, God can save us. But if he does not, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, we're still not going to bow. There's no glory to be found, no faith to be found in being reckless. That's all I have to say about that. All right, next verses. Verse 32. Some cried out one thing, some another. The assembly was in confusion. Most of them didn't know why they had come together. That's what mobs are. They're irrational. So the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward. Alexander, motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd, but they recognized he was a Jew. And for about 2 hours, they all cried out with one voice, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Craziness. Alexander, we don't know who he is either. He's a Jew. I think what's happening is probably the local Jews, whether they're believers or not, are recognizing this crowd is associating us with this message that Paul is preaching, and so let's send one of our own in to try to quiet them down and let them know we're not a threat. But they won't listen to him. Alexander, whoever he is, they won't listen to him. All right. So they keep crying out. For 2 hours, they cry out. And when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, so 2 hours of shouting, they're probably just getting tired. The town clerk comes in. We don't know who he is either. He's just a pragmatic guy who's got some prominence in the town. He says, "Men of Ephesus, who is there that does not know that the city of Ephesians is the temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky?" We're not sure what that is either. Maybe it's a meteorite. Something fell from the sky. I don't know. "On seeing that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash, for you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open. There are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly." And I love this, "For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today." Hey guys, Rome doesn't really care about Artemis or Jesus, but they do care about keeping things in order, so quiet down. It's not Paul and his followers that are causing this riot, it's you guys. Very pragmatic, very pragmatic. There's no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. And when he said these things, he dismissed the assembly. I like that guy. This is kind of a weird chapter. Most of the chapters in Acts have some sort of sermon from Peter or Paul, some sort of spiritual content. This one ends with this sort of pragmatic argument from a secular guy. But I like that Luke chose to stick it here in the book of Acts. It's like, guys, people riot. Christians weren't doing anything weird about, you know, all of this. They weren't out there rioting. They weren't out there picketing. They were just sharing the gospel. Just think about our current culture, and I think about all of the rioting and all of the just the craziness that people are doing on all kinds of different sides, whether Christian or not. And I just wonder how effective it is. The true effective nature, the thing that has caused this whole thing, is Paul is going person by person by person, bringing the gospel, and each person's heart changes, and one heart at a time, the community changes. And I just don't think that riots really make a much effect at all. We want to affect change in any direction. The gospel changing a human heart, and then another human heart, and then it's spreading to another human heart, and another human heart will change your neighborhood, and that'll change your greater neighborhood, and that'll change the city, and the city will change the county, and the county will change the state. And that's what we see starting to happen in Asia Minor as Paul preaches, one thing at a time. Now, when you confront people's idolatry, then you get resistance, and riots will happen in resistance to you. But I love the picture here where it's not the Christians causing the problem. It's not the Christians. It's not the followers of the way doing the vandalism, doing the angry shouting. It's the opposition. I think that could be a lesson for us. All right. So really the hinge of this whole passage, if you want to go to a theological sense, is verse 26, where he says that gods made by hands are not gods. And it, as I was talking with the other pastors about this passage, Perry had just read in his quiet time today out of Isaiah 44, this passage where it describes a man who's a craftsman and he builds idols. So he's like Demetrius. And it says he cuts down this tree. And he says half of it he burns in the fire. Right? So it's very pragmatic. Got this tree, it's wood, he burns in the fire. Over that half, he eats meat. He roasts it, he's satisfied, and he warms himself. He says, aha, I'm warm, I've seen the fire. And the rest of it, the rest of the tree, he makes into a god, his idol. And he falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it, and he says, deliver me, you are my God. I'm going to break things up here. modern-day people, we're just like, it's absurd, right? How do you not see that that's not a god? You cut down the tree. You burned half of it to cook your meat. You made the idol. How is it going to deliver you? It's not possible. It's not a thing. And so modern-day culture, we're like, well, duh. Idolatry, that's not an issue today, right? So I want to move into application for the rest of our time today. I want to make the argument that actually idols persist today. We still do what they did back then, even though logically it seems totally absurd. Like, oh, those are backwards, superstitious people back in the day. They say, because we still worship idols today, and our whole culture does, that gives us, just like it did for Paul back in the Ephesian time, an open door to have a vocabulary for evangelism. And then I want to conclude with, the true message of the gospel relieves the burden of idolatry that everybody feels. And so you have to understand American culture. We're going to talk first of all here about how idols still persist here. You know, so we're almost 2,000 years later. Ephesus kind of receded in our history. If you go there right now, the church really isn't even there. Islam has taken over. It's kind of fascinating. But here we are in America. We're in a distant land compared to what that was. And here we are in America. And one of the things in American culture, you know, I've read multiple books on the subject, about American individualism. And I think about that concept of gods made with human hands not being gods at all. And I think about our American individualism, and I think about when that applies to our beliefs as Americans. We have this foundational freedom idea. Not a bad idea. It's a fantastic idea. I think it's a wonderful culture we've created in a lot of ways. Maybe one of the most free cultures that has ever existed. Our system of government, founded on Christian values, also established pluralism and religious freedom. Fantastic. That is when the church really truly thrives. When the church is the primary force, dominating power of a culture, you can look through history, the next generation of that church is nominal at best if they're believers at all. It's like they get comfortable in their majority. When the church is in direct competition, you can see throughout the whole history of the church, when it's direct competition with another worldview or another religion, and there's the freedom to practice both, the Christian religion always comes out on top because it's the best. It's the only one that's true. And wisdom prevails over generations. And when the church is persecuted and subjugated, it's like it thrives even more. It's just interesting how that works out. But we have this culture, and it's a great culture of pluralistic individualism, where people can take that idea and they can take whatever they want and make it into their own God and declare their truth and their belief and their foundation. Right? We have that as a culture. And it reminds me of that. Paul basically says, hey, we don't have the right to create our own God. I'm not saying we shouldn't give people freedom. We absolutely should. But that's one of our American DNA things that's just in us. I have the right to do what I want. I can create my own thing. And so we think about idols as being like things like addictions with sex and drugs and alcohol. And that's absolutely true. Modern day idols. They control us. We use them to help us cope with life and provide answers. But we all recognize those are very, very bad things. But I think for a lot of us, maybe we don't struggle with those things as much as we struggle with taking the good things of the world, the good things of our lives, and making them greater. Tim Keller wrote at one point, he said, "We think that idols are bad things, but it's almost never the case. The greater the good, the more likely we are to expect that it can satisfy our deepest needs and hopes." And so basically, if there's anything other than God that's functionally more important to establishing your happiness, your identity, your hope, your meaning, that functionally has become your God. And we all, I think, if we really look at it in that light, we go, oh, I could think of two or three things that I feel like I need for my happiness. So basically, it's anything that we look to give us what only God can give us. And I think the most powerful idols are the ones that are actually good things. They're not sins in and of themselves. But it's when we take a good thing and turn it into an ultimate thing, when we take a created thing and turn it into an absolute thing, a necessity that I must have or I must achieve. Like if I had just that thing or this success, then I would be somebody. If I could just get to this place financially, I'd be secure. I'd be fulfilled if I had this person. If I got this position, then I could be somebody. And we elevate it. And we love it more than we love God. And our happiness, our identity, our hope, our meaning starts depending upon it. So they're good things, but we turn them into ultimate things. And that's the very definition of idolatry. One thing I thought of for us might be family. A lot of this, I'm just looking at myself and looking at what I'm currently struggling with as I have kids just on the cusp of entering middle school, and we've got all the things flooding into our world, things that maybe for their education or for their, you know, their well-rounded activities and sports and social stuff and just all the things that our culture is pressuring, I'm starting to feel the pressure. Family can be a very, very potent idol for kids, for young people, even for us adults. Our parents' approval. Living up to their expectations can be an incredibly powerful idol. Career, money, achievement, acclaim, maybe your looks. We live in a very looks-dependent culture. Social media proves that out. Maybe the looks of your partner. That's a pretty big deal. Maybe it's your political cause, a social cause. It justifies your existence because you've put your all behind it. Your competence or your skill at a particular task or field or career. And so we look at the ancient times and we go, wow, that's so weird. These superstitious people, you know, they have a god on every corner. They have their agriculture god and their sex god and their war god and their work god and their play god. And there's a god behind every activity, the financial god, the god of arts and the god of music. And it's the same thing we do. We're just really covert about it. They were obvious about it. It was out on the table. We have education and power and influence. I think Fort Collins particularly, we have so many of these temptations, God of money and success. And so our culture, and you can start looking at American culture and you start realizing as Christianity and religious sentiment has kind of faded into the background, we've never been more religious. I don't think we've ever had more gods than we have right now. And it's crushing us. it is crushing us. It's like religion fades to the background, but it provided an answer for people, a justification for existence, alleviation of guilt, so many things. And now the world is providing alternate answers. And those alternate answers are making everything worse for our meaning, our identity, our hope, our happiness. It's crushing us. I study this stuff primarily because I love the gospel, and I love it when people understand it and come to know Jesus Christ. And so I want to know, what is our world thinking? So you can turn to people sometimes. There's a comedian turned actor, turned influencer who, he was a heroin addict at one point. He was a sex addict for a while. Very introspective guy, very eloquent guy, very crass guy. He's been arrested, drunk driving for drugs, all kinds of stuff over the years. He's been through 12-step rehab. He's just all kinds of stuff. This guy, I picture sort of like Solomon back in the day. Take God out of the picture completely and have a guy success who has dabbled in everything in life and found it meaningless and hopeless. Russell Brand. He said this. I got part of the quote up there. I'll read the rest of it. He says, there's an ongoing sense. He's not a Christian. He says, there's an ongoing sense that this modern life isn't working. There was an important job that religion was doing, but because of X, Y, or Z, we have possibly quite rightly rejected it. But the secularization, the materialization, the individualization of the way we see the world now excludes us from a life that has a meaning. I don't think pop culture can fill that gap anymore. I don't think art can do it anymore. Things are getting too serious. People need to be connected with something that's essential and beautiful and valuable and true. And so his current belief, as far as I can tell, is the secular vision of faith that he has in his 12-step recovery program is his newfound faith. I wonder what's going to happen when he discovers that ultimately, under human suffering and sin and death, that will completely crumble when he starts encountering those things more fully. I read a book by a secular psychologist some years ago. It's called The Righteous Mind, a guy named Jonathan Haidt. He made the case in that book that an obsession with righteousness is the normal human condition. He's not a Christian, but we're all obsessed with this. I need a justification for my existence. David Zall wrote a book called Seculosity, and he combined the word secular with religiosity, basically as a catch-all for all the religious feelings, the sentiment, the energy that's all in our modern world directed at earthly rather than heavenly objects. And so instead of calling our culture religiosity, he calls it seculosity, but it's the same exact thing as religion. It's a new worship in a sense, but he calls it enoughness, which I thought was actually quite brilliant as a commentary on our current culture, because we're now experiencing something akin to the worst parts of toxic religion. In that we're too religious about too many things, and it's creating an immense burden on our whole society. It's the things that we lean on. Am I blank enough? It tells us we're okay, that our lives matter, right? It's our guilt management system. It's the justifying story of our life. And so you hear and you see stories about people who are scrambling to be successful enough, happy enough, thin enough, wealthy enough, influential enough, desired enough, charitable enough, woke enough, good enough. One day I'm going to reach this benchmark. I'm going to achieve it. And then I'll be enough. We end up like this. Cruella de Vil. This is me. That was a crazy part of the movie, actually, if you remember that movie. Just chasing after the thing with all the 101 Dalmatians. Anyway, me trying to excel in my career, maintain a social life, drink enough water, exercise, text everyone back, stay sane, survive, and be happy. You ever feel like this? In your day-to-day life? It's kind of like all of us are experiencing some of this. Or maybe, you know, if you're in business, it's like this. Rockefeller, how much money is enough, Mr. Rockefeller? He's the richest man on the planet at the time. Just a little bit more. It's never enough, no matter what we end up achieving. And even if you look at our current industries. What used to be material production, farming and manufacturing, now people are creating businesses booming around manufacturing identity, meaning. And so instead of selling a shaving razor to women, you sell a bulwark against toxic masculinity. It's almost humorous. But business is booming in that. CrossFit, it's a new church. I'm not saying that exercising is bad, but you're leaning on something to tell you that you're okay, and it becomes a justifying story of your life. We spend our days climbing these ladders towards some dream of enoughness, and we end up lonely and exhausted and divided. I can think about the old days, and there was the god Molech, and they would sacrifice children in the fire. And I think about the 19 years, in May, it'll be 19 years that I've been on staff with this church, and think about all the families that have come through, and I've seen kids go from diapers to adulthood. And I believe I've seen child sacrifice. Because I've seen children sacrificed at the altar of dad's career, which was his idol. I've seen children sacrificed at the altar of mom's comfort, mom's free time. I've seen children sacrificed by their parents on the altar of the child's own education. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, the best education, the best career, but forfeits his soul? What are we doing? Why are we so attracted to being enough? It's like in a lot of cases, our children are not souls to be won. They're just skills to be maximized. And it's no wonder in today's world, because it's everywhere, that our young adults are feeling crushed under the burden of living. And anxiety is everywhere. There's a guy who wrote in New York Magazine named Andrew Sullivan. He wrote that everyone has a way of life. I think he was an atheist, actually, is what I kind of got out of reading it. But he said, everyone has a way of life, a religion of sorts, but a practice rather than a theory. It's a way of life that gives you meaning, but it's a meaning that cannot be really defended without recourse to some transcendent value, some undying truth, or God, or gods. And he said, the need for meaning hasn't gone away, but without Christianity, the yearning looks to politics for satisfaction. So he was talking about politics in 2018 when he wrote the article. He said, the totalizing political narrative is absolutely intoxicating in a way that the religious narrative isn't. So the political lens and its drama, its life, that it tries to explain everything going on in life. And it tells a person it can fix everything that's happening, but it's dangerous because it can't fix it. And so we have all of these impulses that are built into us for idolatry, and they're finding expression in things like political cults. But all cultish impulses demand total and immediate commitment to save the world, which fills the void that Christianity has left as it's faded away in a lot of ways in our secular world, but without any of the wisdom and the culture and the foundation of biblical values. And so if you have a system that demands total and immediate commitment to save the world, whether that's through a social cause or the products you purchase or your advocacy for something or whatever it is, it's going to set people into tribes that will only clash with one another. Because they're against your ideal that you see will save the world. And so we saw in our passage today, ancient people rioting because their idolatry is being called out. And have you been pricked by anything I've said so far? Because I wrestle oftentimes before I get up here. I was wrestling last night. I wrestle with insecurity. Is God going to speak through me? Do I fully understand what's going to happen here? Who am I going to offend that's going to come down on me throughout the week? do I have anything to say? When I open my mouth, are words going to come out that are coherent? Are people going to judge me? Are they going to laugh at me inside? Am I going to make a spectacle? All the different things I wrestle with, but probably the most powerful one is the feeling of hypocrisy. Because I'm looking at my life and I'm going, what are my own idols? What do I need to call myself out on? Well, one of them is food. I'm a snob. And I like a lot of food. Why? Because it gives me happiness. Sometimes it gives me purpose. When I set my mind and my hands to preparing something, it's not a bad thing, but when I make it an ultimate thing and my identity is shaped by it, man, I can smoke some meat. It's an idol. We were at a conference last week as pastors, and a friend of mine was there. We're both pastors, but when we bond over guitar pedals because we're both fascinated by it. Not a lot of people want to talk about such nerdy things. But we were thinking about idols and our message and what we're passionate about, and we both realized over dinner last Thursday that maybe we speak about guitar technology more than we speak about Jesus Christ. I was wrestling last night with my own hypocrisy. Wrestling with my own feelings of where am I falling into this enoughness. And it's sin. And that's what I think our world doesn't quite understand. They do their causes like somehow they're going to save humanity without recognizing the problem in the human heart is sin. Aldous Huxley said, it's the fact that you and I are both simultaneously the pillars and the dynamite in our own house. Sin. All of the world's stuff, wisdom, programs, cults, causes turn to dust under the weight of sin. They don't have sin. These things don't have answers for human suffering and death. They don't have something that transcends that. And our culture feels heavy. And so remember I said that idols persist today. And because of this, I think there's an open door to evangelism, because no matter how backward you might think Christianity feels right now, I've talked to a lot of you guys who just feel like, I can't open my mouth about Jesus because somebody talks about this big, you know, I'm believing some guy in the clouds that, you know, supernatural doesn't exist, yada, 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 and I just feel like I just can't share the gospel anymore. I'm telling you there's an open door, because if you start talking about this enoughness concept and the weight of how we're trying to shape our own identities and feel enough about all these different things, every single person can relate to it because we're all crushed under it. And it opens up the door to the gospel. So it's an evangelism opportunity for us. Because the gospel relieves the burden. That was my third point of application. Idolatry persists today. It's an open door to evangelism because everybody's dealing with this weight. Just a little bit more, Mr. Rockefeller. The gospel relieves the burden. In the gospel is grace. Capital G, all caps, shout it from the mountaintops, grace. You want to talk to people who feel indifferent when you start talking about atonement and, you know, things like that? Mention grace or give them grace. These discussions can be very productive with people in our culture who are feeling crushed under the weight of their idols' demands. But it's not going to come easily. They don't lay down their idols easily, just as the Ephesians didn't. They rioted. There's a cost. What happens today when you bump up against someone's enoughness, whether it's their political cause or whatever, what happens today is there is no mercy. There's no redemption. You are canceled. You are done. Your social media account may be deleted. Whatever happens, you're done. Your influence is over. No redemption. There's a cost. There's a weight. When we lay down idols or ask someone else to do it, there's a cost to it. And I think because if you look at idolatry in the Old Testament prophets equated it to a spiritual adultery, just like a woman going from her husband into the arms of another man, the nation of Israel turning to idols, they would turn away from God in an act of unfaithfulness. And the penalty for that for humans was death. And I read a Jewish commentator one time talking about idolatry who said this weird metaphor of Israel committing adultery doesn't add up, because in Hosea and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, God says, I'm going to take you and I'm going to divorce you because of your spiritual adultery, because there's a cost. But then he says, I'm going to bring you back. And they said, wait a minute, the penalty should be death. It should be done and over. So I guess the metaphor doesn't work. But if you read the New Testament, you understand absolutely it does, because in order for Jesus to have his people in his arms, he still needed to pay the penalty of death, the cost for the spiritual adultery. And it held up. When Jesus went to the cross, he died the death that we deserved. He died the death that we deserved. And I just think about that. I think about the burden that Jesus must have had to feel. Think about the crushing weight that we can feel when we're looking at enoughness, as I described it. You go to the book of Luke. Toward the end, Jesus, in Luke 22, it says, he withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them. That's his disciples. He knelt down and prayed. He's about to go to the cross and take on the crushing weight of the world's adultery, the world's idolatry. He said, Father, if you're willing, take this cup from me. He was feeling the heaviness. He opened up my pack and found my cast iron pot of lust, of desire for food, of desire for my children to achieve, of desire for my own eloquence and my reputation in this world, the weight that I've been carrying around my whole life. And he opened up my pack. He said, I can take that burden. And in front of his father, it says, an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. He took that weight to the cross. And on that cross, as he breathed his last, he said, it is finished. It's enough. The Gospel of John, that it is finished, the Greek word that's translated, it is finished, tetelestai. It's an accounting term that says paid in full, the debt taken care of. Think about the heavy burden of my idolatry and sin. The crushing weight of that put on my Savior on the cross. He paid the cost. He took the rage, the burden. And there was a crowd that screamed, crucify him, and enraged. And Paul walked away from that crowd. I think he rightly did that. But Jesus, he didn't deserve to walk into that crowd's rage. He didn't deserve to walk into certain death. But he did it willingly. He went up on that cross. He went straight into it, and he took its full force to take the burden away. I love this verse in Colossians 2:15. Having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. And so as we share about Jesus in today's world, as we share to a world that's heavily burdened by their own idolatry, their own religiosity, even though it's secular, we should scream from the mountaintops the good news of grace. That nothing that needs to be done hasn't already been done. The work is done. It is finished. It seems counterintuitive, but it is true. Enoughness is not something for us to achieve. It's a gift that's given and received. Freely given. And the only scorekeeping of enoughness that matters in this light has come to an end through the work of Jesus Christ. Whether you feel it or not, however you might feel in this moment, it's done. It's done. So my exhortation to us as we close here is that we simply look at the cross. And we consider what our idols might be, what our burdens might be that we're holding, that we're carrying in a backpack in our journey of life. It's crushing us. Are you willing to just lay that down at the feet of Jesus? Band, come on up. Are you willing to lay it down at the feet of Jesus? Surrender it. Let it go. It is for freedom that Christ has set you free. Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden. I will give you rest." A deep spiritual rest for your soul. And my prayer is that it would affect our economy. It would affect the economy of Fort Collins. That we would go out and we would see that there are souls to be won and there's a message to be communicated, that we have a viable answer to the burden that everybody's carrying. But for right now, let's just engage with the Lord and surrender to Him. Why don't you guys lead us?